September 11th. And it's understandable that people worry something similar could happen here. Watching the events in Paris made the threat feel closer to home. So as we go into Thanksgiving weekend, I want the American people to know is that we are taking every possible step to keep our homeland safe. First, we're going after ISIL wherever it hides. That's been our strategy for more than a year. I'll speak about this in more detail in the coming weeks, but let me remind the American people of what our coalition of some 65 nations is doing to destroy these terrorists and defeat their ideology. So far, our military and our partners have conducted more than 8,000 airstrikes on ISIL strongholds and equipment. Those airstrikes, along with the efforts of our partners on the ground, have taken out key leaders, have taken back territory from ISIL in both Iraq and Syria. We continue to work to choke off their financing and their supply lines and their counter their recruitment and their messaging. And even as America is already supporting French airstrikes in Syria, yesterday President Hollande and I agreed that our countries are going to step up that coordination even further and do more of that work together. So we're stepping up the pressure on ISIL where it lives, and we will not let up, adjusting our tactics when necessary until they are beaten. That's our first goal. Second, we continue to do everything possible to prevent attacks at home and abroad and to prevent foreign terrorist fighters from entering the United States or other nations. Since 9/11, we've taken extraordinary measures to strengthen our homeland security in everything from aviation security to border security to information sharing. We've improved upon these actions over time. Anytime there's an event, we learn something from it, and we continue to refine them. We continue to improve.
All right, y'all, welcome to the show. Dear leaders, talking about the war here. Let's listen in.
Information I just received in the Situation Room. It is similar to the information the briefing that I received on Saturday before I left on my trip last week. So as Americans travel this weekend to be with their loved ones, I want them to know that our counterterrorism, intelligence, homeland security, and law enforcement professionals at every level are working overtime. They are continually monitoring threats at home and abroad, continually evaluating our security posture. They're constantly working to protect all of us. Their work has prevented attacks. Their efforts have saved lives. They serve every hour of every day for the sake of our security. They did so before Paris, and they do so now, without fanfare or credit, and without a break for the holidays. So the bottom line is this. I want the American people to know, entering the holidays, that the combined resources of our military, our intelligence, and our homeland security agencies are on the case. They're vigilant, relentless, and effective. In the event of a specific credible threat, the public will be informed. We do think it's useful for people as they're going about their business to be vigilant. If you see something suspicious, say something. That's always helpful. But otherwise, Americans should go about their usual Thanksgiving weekend activities, spending time with family and friends, and celebrating our blessings. And while the threat of terrorism is a troubling reality of our age, we are both equipped to prevent attacks, and we are resilient in the face of those who would try to do us harm. And that's something we can all be thankful for. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Shut up. Anyway, so more of the same, which, hey, could be worse, man. And actually, I missed the beginning of it, so it could be that he was threatening more ground troops, but I don't think so. And step up some airstrikes and the same horrible thing, but at least if he announced a major escalation. And I missed it. All right. Anyway, well, it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, well, isn't that nice? The Future Freedom Foundation morning email has changed. It's so sharp looking. Yeah, show remote content in this message there. Oh, yeah, that looks nice. Enslaving people to keep them safe from government-produced enemies. That sounds like a Future Freedom Foundation article to me. I'm betting Hornberger. Yeah, Hornberger's blowing there. All right. Let's see here. Alex Navratash. Absolute. Hey, great. Guess what, everybody? Gonna have a bunch of interviews on the show today. Boy, I better talk fast about how much I hate everything before we get to the interviews. Oh, boy, and I better ask him how to say his name right, because I know I don't know how to say his name right. Grant Smith, he's gonna be on. I know how to say that. Grant Smith, he's gonna be on to talk about just who all was cheering for the 9/11 attacks that day. And also about Jonathan Pollard. And then Alex Navratash is going to be on to talk about the glory of allowing refugees into America. The wonderfulness of it all. Oh, don't tell me that you believed, thought you knew that something a right-winger told you was correct. Don't you know they're a bunch of stupid, lying idiots who don't know their ass from a hole in the ground? No. Refugees are awesome. More refugees, please. Justin Raimondo says, we can't allow any refugees from any countries we're bombing. Oh, really? I think we ought to allow the refugees from the countries we're bombing to take any property they feel like in America. We owe it to them. Reparations. And start with the warmongers' houses. Start with the congressmen and the senators, the judges, the soldiers, the officers, the bureaucrats. Give their land to the Syrians, to the Iraqis, to the Afghans. Oh, no. Hire them to keep the refugees out. That makes perfect sense. You know what we need? More government. You know, to prevent civilians from acting. Huh? Anyway, Alex Navratash, Navraste, something, whatever. He did the mathematics for you. And he's going to break down the mathematics. Oh, I know. Conservatives hate numbers. Conservatives hate freedom. And they fear everything. And hate what they fear and will come up with any excuse to believe whatever stupid crap they want in order to justify the way they behave because of their fears. But then there's the real world that we live in. And of course, I'm picking on the conservatives because they're worse on it. But the liberals are horrible too. There's a great article by, and the Democrats especially, great article by Eric Schuller, who's taken to writing for us at antiwar.com here lately. And this one is called Stop the Political Grandstanding on Refugees. I think it ran yesterday. No, it's running today. Stop the Political Grandstanding on Refugees. It's really good. And let's see. I'm going to fast forward here to the Democrat part. Let's see. Everybody knows what's so horrible about the conservatives. Then we must turn our attention to the Democrats and precisely what American values we're discussing here. At least on the surface, the argument presented by Obama and his defenders is a persuasive one. But if the Obama administration has taught us anything, it's that one must always look beneath the rhetoric. At a recent press conference at the G20 summit in Turkey, Obama called on more nations to contribute resources to the refugee crisis, noting the U.S. has donated thus far $4.5 billion. Obama also said we must accept more refugees, but ensure our own security in the process. His present plan calls for accepting 10,000 Syrian refugees by next year. And Secretary of State John Kerry recently announced the U.S. would be increasing acceptance of all refugees from Syria and elsewhere to 85,000 per year by 2016, rising to 100,000 per year by 2017. This compares with just 70,000 per year right now. The trouble is that, given the vast scope of the crisis sweeping the Middle East and North Africa, this effort is all but meaningless. To see this, let's run down the numbers. And to keep it conservative, we'll restrict our focus to those countries in which the U.S. and its allies have militarily intervened in one way or the other. Almost 12 million from Syria, 4 million from Iraq, more than 500,000 from Yemen, almost 500,000 from Libya, 2.5 million from Somalia, almost 4 million from Afghanistan, and almost 2 million from Pakistan. Total, almost 25 million refugees, according to the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. And again, those are just the ones from the countries America's been at war with. And then Schuller writes, so in the table above, internally displaced persons, yeah. These are essentially in people who are forced to flee their homes, but until they actually leave the country, they're not technically refugees. In terms of desperation, though, there isn't much difference. Meanwhile, the refugee column include a small number of asylum seekers, which are defined slightly differently. But again, when we're talking about suffering and risk, it's the kind of distinction without a difference. All of these individuals in the table above are identified by the UNHCR as part of the population of concern. So anyway, he goes back in. Check this article. Read this article right now. It's at antiwar.com. Stop the political grandstanding on refugees. All of Obama's greatest pretended efforts are just that, pretended.
Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. And I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday, and The Future of Freedom with FFF Founder and President Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right, y'all. I'm Scott. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Haha, I went off on my big goddang refugee tangent there, and I forgot to say, oh yeah, and Trevor Tim's going to be on the show too, to talk about, you know, the war on encryption and all that kind of thing. What the? That's terrible. I don't know what's going on. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Man, is that really right? That's not right, dude. What are you talking about? Hang on. I gotta check this. Scott Horton Show, iTunes. Let me see here, man. Nope, that was the wrong button to click. That's the one I meant. Let's see. Nope. Well, I just got an email saying, hey, man, I got nothing for you after the end of October. And I'm saying, really, because this seems up to date as of yesterday. And let me see about the interview feed. The interview feed, too, has got up through the 13th, at least, which is not very good. But still. Maybe different podcast feed. Maybe he's getting them off of Stitcher. Hey, chat room guys. Any of you guys? Well, I guess you listen live, so you don't get the show off Stitcher, right? Yeah, what the hell? Who cares? Anyway, I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And let's talk about Laquan McDonald. Supposedly, he was burglarizing cars and got the cops called on him. And it was about a year ago in Chicago. And the cop that murdered him was getting away with it until an independent journalist sued. And for some reason, the judge ruled that the pigs had to release the dash cam footage of the killing of the kid. He was 17. That's a kid to me because I'm in my late 30s. I mean, 17 is old enough to be getting in trouble, but in this case, the worst he was accused of doing, I believe, is burglary. That is an attack on property with no civilians present, no threat to an innocent person, you know, your money or your life. That's a robbery. Burglary is nobody's around. Let me see if I could sneak off and steal some things. And even then, that's still simply an accusation. And wholly besides the point, other than explaining why it was the cops were called in the first place, was that that was the accusation. The cops pull up. The cop gets out of his car. Laquan McDonald is a full lane away from him on a four-lane street. They're in an industrial area in the middle of nowhere, basically. It's not like there's a bunch of houses and kids. It's at night, and there are no family structures around anywhere or anything like that. He's across a full lane of the street, and he's not moving toward the cop at all. He's walking away. If you watch the footage, you might think that here in a second he's going to break out running. It's probably what you'll anticipate when you see him going, oh, that cop's getting a little close to me on his left side. So he starts walking off toward his right, walking away. The cop shoots him 16 times to death before the rest of the cops even had a chance to start shooting too. In order to make sure it looked legit, that's the rule. If your buddy ever shoots anybody, you gotta start shooting too. That way, it'll be agreement that you had to. No discrepancy of how come everybody else didn't shoot then. And that way you make sure he's all the way dead so he can't testify against you. Well, in this case, the other cops didn't even have a chance to draw their guns. The first one just shot him. And from the very, and the kid, again, there's no lunge. They lied and lied and lied and claimed, oh, he lunged at the cop with a knife and gave him no choice. There's no lunge, anything like that. From the moment he shot once, he falls straight to the ground. He turns around and falls down all in one motion. He's fallen from the instant he shot. And the cop shoots him 15 more times. And it's from far away. And you can't see the cop the way the camera angle is. You can see the first shot and that's it. The rest of it, you can only see the victim, the corpse, laying there on the ground taking bullet after bullet after bullet after bullet. Now, he should be charged with desecrating a corpse at that point. The kid's already dead, dead, dead. And the cop is just shooting him and shooting him and shooting him. He had a high capacity magazine, you understand. Good enough for government work. Just not for you. And they were going to let him get away with it. The cop was going to get away with it. Because even if he wasn't on a federal task force, he still got de facto sovereign immunity. He still got the protection of 10,000 laws and processes meant to keep him out of prison no matter what. He's a government employee. The cop is a government employee. He's not our public servant. Who told you that? One of your overlords told you that. In government school, where your masters teach you that you elect them and you give them power and you choose them and the things that they do, they're only representing you, the rational grown adults of America participating in our wonderful democracy. We are the government. You know how many times I've had civilians, private sector people say to me, we are the government. They really believe that. People really believe that. Is Laquan McDonald the government when the McDonald, when the McGovernment is shooting him 16 times? After he's already dead, right? I had 10 of them. He's shooting a corpse. It's debatable. We don't know exactly when the last exhale came. But now here's the rub. They're charging the cop with first degree murder. And you know what that is? That is accessory to murder right there for the DA. You see what he's doing? He's conspiring with the murderer cop to set him free by overcharging him. The charge is murder two. Second degree murder. First degree murder means with premeditation. And of course, they're not going to be able to prove that unless, and yeah, right. You would have to have the other cop say, oh my God, and he was yelling the N-word the whole time. He said, I'm going to get you, you N-word, because you're an N-word, and then open fire. If one of the other cops was to testify to that, there's your first degree murder. But you see what the prosecutor's trying to do is overcharge him so he can win an acquittal. At the expense of, you know, Laquan McDonald. The dead guy who gets no justice.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime future freedom author Scott McPherson. Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the thing here. Oh, I should turn my backup recorder on just in case. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm him, and our first guest today is our friend Grant Smith of the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy. That's IRMEP, I-R-M-E-P, IRMEP.org. And here's what you do. You search site for .pdf, and then just see what happens. Yeah.
Beware.
See, yeah, he's like the Jason Leopold of the Israel lobby only issue. And that's what he does. Grant Smith, he is the FOIA ninja of the East Coast. And kicks the Israel lobby's ass all day long. He's written about 10 books based on all the documents he's gotten about FBI counterintelligence investigations of Israeli spies in our country and all their nefarious deeds and all the rest of it. And really good stuff. Stealing weapons-grade uranium and the whole works. So very happy to have you back here on the show. I saw on Twitter you're putting out this press release to everybody, just mocking them for refusing to say the most obvious thing, which is the obvious truth, when they're refuting Donald Trump for accusing the Muslims of New Jersey for celebrating the September 11th attack. They've refused to acknowledge what we know they know. It's in the archives. When they go back to do the research, to do the debunking, they've got to come across the fact that somebody was celebrating the September 11th attack on September 11th outside in broad daylight in front of people. But who were they, Grant?
Well, can you hear me okay?
I can hear just fine.
Yeah. Who can possibly know? I mean, when Glenn Kessler of the Washington Post started to answer that very question, he just couldn't bring himself to say it either. So It was the Israelis. They're the ones who were documented. They're the ones who were hauled in by the FBI after they were tipped by a witness or an eyewitness, who saw some celebrating going on, but they weren't Arabs and they weren't Muslims. They were some Israeli movers, who were celebrating, and taking pictures and having fun, as the towers were going down. So I think it's incredible, and you have this groundswell. It's not just me, but of all sorts of people who remember that, who read the alternative press accounts of it. I mean, it's been fairly well known since 2005, that there was this very curious celebration going on in New Jersey, and it seems as though Trump had that in mind when he started going off about Arabs and Muslims celebrating this. But,
well, I'm not so sure about that part, because apparently there were rumors then that that Muslims were holding rooftop parties and were tailgating, and it was because they were Arabs and sympathized with the terrorists. But the reporters tried to track it down then, and they couldn't find any evidence of it whatsoever. The best they found was, oh yeah, well, I heard that somewhere because somebody said that. So I'm not certain that this is the event that Trump necessarily got confused. He may have been thinking of those initial false reports. And of course, I thought this was a funny little side note that Ben Carson initially said, yeah, that's right, I saw that too. And then he backtracked and he said, oh no, you know what I saw was, Muslims in the Middle East celebrating it. But that was a hoax too. That was footage of Palestinians celebrating some little kid's birthday or something, and they put it on TV and said, look, here's the West Bank today, joyous celebrations of the 9/11 attacks, and it was a damn lie.
Yeah, there's a lot of manipulation going on of overseas videos. That's been fairly well established. And it's, of course, you're right. Who can know what was in the mind of
this
Trump
freak,
when he made the, who wants to get in that mind? But,
I mean, I think it was more likely that he heard those initial false reports, not necessarily this one, but as long as he's bringing up who was celebrating what, why in the world, Grant, would a bunch of Israelis celebrate a horrible attack on their greatest allies on the planet Earth, the United States of America?
Well, the, people who were later interviewed on a talk show in Israel, and their names are known. They've come out about it, Kurzbergs and Shmuel and Elner and Gabriel Marmari. They explained that, you know, this was a common occurrence in Israel, and so they had a different view when they saw those towers coming down than your typical American would have had, or at least, you know, that's their self-reporting. So, you know, we have that to go on, but
didn't they talk to the cop? Didn't they say to the cop, I'm paraphrasing, not quoting here, but something close to, see, you know, we're not your problem. You shouldn't be arresting us. We're not your problem. We're Israelis. They're your problem, the Muslims, see? And we're like you, and you're like us, and they are our enemy together, and this kind of
thing. Yeah, that's true. The Palestinians are the problem. We're not the problem. And so they were a very curious
footnote,
fixture.
By the way, so people know, there was not a single Palestinian on any of those four airplanes that day, nor a single Iraqi, Iranian, or Syrian, just to be clear. I'm sorry.
Right. They had a narrative they're rolling out to the cops, who apparently, you know, were so edgy and suspicious anyway, they refused to appreciate it. But yeah, they were some characters and operating illegally in the U.S. They had a moving company called Urban Moving Systems. And actually, you know, the importance of any of this stuff, I think, is fairly minimal in terms of the actual FBI files. As I said, they've been out since 2005. We went through a FOIA for them again in 2013, more as an exercise in seeing whether they were going to accelerate any declassification of the sensitive stuff, and they didn't. But it was an instance of a very fairly substantial employment outfit that was using a lot of illegal labor and violating visas and all sorts of other problems that caused the company to pretty much fold up its operations and leave. So it, you know, without going back and looking at all of the details, the one thing that struck me is one of my favorite reporters, Glenn Kessler, who is, of course, the recipient of the classified information obtained by AIPAC to gin up a war with Iran back in the day in 2004-2005. He's the one who's supposedly debunking all of this with a big story. And he mentions FBI probes. And then he mentions that, quote, reporters who wrote the story did not recall whether the allegations were ever confirmed, unquote. As if because the Washington Post didn't want to follow up, it's just unknowable what happened with these FBI allegations. But, you know, I just thought it was clear, and you saw the Twitter campaign. It was clear that, you know, in the debunking stories, there was an FBI investigation. There were celebrations that right. caused law enforcement to prick up its ears, and that it goes against the narrative, which is, of course, the bigger story, the sweeping narrative that Arabs and Muslims are possible terrorist conspirators, which has right. come out of, you know, fear of the Paris attacks.
Well, there's another way of saying what you just said, though, which is it's a giant damned lie by omission. And this is why they make you swear to tell the whole truth when you testify in court, because right. you can get away with misleading the hell out of people by telling them half of what's true, but nothing that's outright false. But if you lie by omission, it's still a lie.
Right. And some of the very first stories about this were horrible. The New York Post was talking about Middle Easterners celebrating. They were referring to this story, but again, they couldn't quite bring themselves to, you know, avoid that error of omission or lie of omission. And so their stories, which are still available, are just, you know, they're as bad as these sweeping allegations. So I agree. But, yeah, I've been monitoring this story, and I still don't see very much uptake, of the idea that, yeah, there was an investigation. Oh, by the way, no, it wasn't, it wasn't Arab and Muslims, because that doesn't fit the narrative. I mean, you're lucky you don't live in Washington D.C. and
listen to
Frank Gaffney. He has a radio program here, and it's just nonstop hatred. And it's just unbelievable, but
hysteria. Yeah, he is the wackiest of the neocons. That Gaffney, and never was confirmed as anything like he claims to have been in the Defense Department in the Reagan years. Anyway, we'll be right back with Grant Smith in just a sec, y'all.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund, and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I got Grant Smith on the line. New Jersey 9/11 celebrants were Israelis, is his piece on the blog today at antiwar.com. Go and read that. But, yeah, so let me ask you now about Jonathan Pollard. Who's Jonathan Pollard?
Jonathan Pollard is the former Navy analyst, intelligence analyst, who was arrested and charged with espionage and convicted. Well, pled guilty in 1987. He's been in jail up until very recently, serving a life term, 30 years, for espionage on behalf of the Israelis. He was paid by them to get some very sensitive information from the U.S. There's a lot that's not known about it still. There's not really much reporting that does anything more than cover the least important aspects of it. But it's been charged that two important things. Number one, that there was somebody much higher up who was tasking him to get specific file numbers. And we've never been able to get any evidence that that investigation went anywhere or that there even was a bona fide investigation at NCIS or the FBI. Mm-hmm. And number two, Seymour Hersh did a big piece saying that the Israelis used the information obtained by Pollard as sort of bargaining information, trading it with the Soviets to get immigrants to go to Israel and keep that flow going back in the 80s. So it's a hugely important story, but kind of like this whole debunking of the previous story, there's no real reporting on it. And from kind of a 30,000-foot level, Pollard's really the only person in recent history who's been prosecuted. All of the other cases, Ben-Ami Kadosh, who was about as bad, also caught, Israeli spy, Stuart Nazet, caught, but then the investigation was tailored in a way that it eliminated any Israeli involvement. The AIPAC-2, United Against Nuclear Iran, which was trafficking in classified information. You know, none of those cases ever went anywhere. So Pollard is kind of the exception that proves the rule, as even he would have said, that Israel can't be prosecuted for espionage, or almost never is.
And he's out now on parole, huh?
He's out, but there's no real good reporting on what he's up to. There, it's said that he was offered a job at a financial services firm on Wall Street. It's gone a little sour because the feds wanted to install a bunch of monitoring equipment on the computers as well as on him. So the firm apparently said, no way. You know, if this were anybody else, we'd know the name of the firm and how he came to get the job and all that. But there's, like, there's no reporting on
any
of that.
If they have nothing to hide, what are they worried about?
I don't know. I think that, well, the job's off anyway, so he's apparently out there, and according to everything that's available, he's going to be in the U.S. for the next 5 years.
He'll be writing a commentary magazine in a week.
We'll see, but there's been a real strategy. Mort Klein, a conference of presidents of major organizations here in the U.S., has talked about how it's important not to, you know, celebrate too loudly or, you know, write stories about Jonathan Pollard being a hero and all of this stuff. And there's been Benjamin Netanyahu's tried to corral his Knesset into not celebrating or doing anything that would raise the profile of this. But, you know, it's been a fairly quiet story, and nobody's making a lot of noise.
And this is all about Israel and Iran, isn't it?
Well,
I mean, because
point,
if the Fed said, nah, we don't want you to give them parole, then they wouldn't have got parole. They arranged this.
I tend to think that nobody got anything out of this. He was going to be eligible for parole, and it seems as though he finally stopped assuming or wishing that intervention would get him out. There was some initial maneuver by the Obama administration to use him as a bargaining chip before his value expired. But I looked long and hard, and there wasn't anything going on at the pardon attorney that we could see. There wasn't any special deal making. So it looks as though once the 30 years came up, they really did just say, well, he's eligible. He's been a good boy. So why not let him out?
But again, though, all the DOJ would have had to do would be to insist that please don't let him out, like they would do if it was Charles Manson or whatever other point, right?
Yeah, absolutely. If they'd wanted to play hardball.
And that wouldn't have been an under-the-table kind of a thing. That would have been a perfectly legitimate thing, right, for the prosecutors to say, we would like to remind the parole board about the damage that this person did to this innocent family or this innocent country or whatever it is.
Yeah, I think they could have done that. On the side of Pollard, though, they would have insisted that he's probably served more time for espionage than anybody in recent memory. I mean, there have been some.
Well,
some
but he was sentenced to life, though, right?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But life can be life, or life can be. You know, it's not like
there was no parole in federal.
It's not
prison.
Like he was had a pound of marijuana or something, Scott.
Yeah, no.
Come on.
But wait, I guess I'm confused about it, Grant, because I thought that there was no parole in federal prison. Only state prisons have parole, and in federal time, you do your whole time. That's it.
Yeah, I have to admit, I'm not a lawyer, and I don't know anything about that particular aspect. What I do
I don't know where I thought I learned that, but apparently that's
most of the
wrong.
Action on his case has been with the pardon attorney, you know, up to about 5 years ago, where they were really sending in hundreds of signatures from members of Congress and all sorts of other influentials saying that we need a pardon here, and heavy pressure applied on President Bush, heavy pressure applied on Clinton, going all the way back. And, of course, yeah. But in terms of whether he was going to be stuck in the pokey for the rest of his life, it looked as though life in this always meant 30 years. I've never seen anything indicating that he was ever really going to be in there for life.
Hmm. All right. All right, yeah. And then so now tell me more about or whatever it is you think you know, or whatever the accusations are, at least, about who may have been feeding him the numbers to of the paperwork that they wanted, because apparently this was from above him on the pay grade scale.
Right. Well, this is we've hit a dead end. I mean, the trail leads to NCIS, and they were really at the forefront of the investigation. They have the biggest file, and
that's the Navy intelligence, counterintelligence,
criminal investigation criminal service, and so querying their database, which is unstructured, they have not been able to produce anything about their investigation of so-called of the mole who is feeding all of this, all of these code, for the files. So, you know, that's a question. I mean, if there were going to be any reporting about this story at all, it would be what happened to that investigation? Why wasn't somebody else ever found? And that's, you know, that's gone nowhere. I've been very curious about that. That seems to me to be the relevant question, but you know, we do know that Ben-Ami Kadish, who had a brother in Israel who's in missile, development. He was feeding him all sorts of stuff at the same time, but he just got a slap on the wrist and then died a few years later. Same sort of thing, being fed. So there was this fairly robust spy ring pursuing military secrets, being very successful about it. Mm-hmm. It's no big story, though, that the investigation petered out, because that's what always happens. I mean, the multiple investigations of AIPAC for espionage always peter out at a certain point. But there's just no real information that they ever really got anywhere or wanted to get anywhere in uncovering the bigger network. So we may never know.
And now, is this the source that is termed Mega? And where does that come from? That comes from Bamford's second book or something, right? Where's that come from?
Yeah, I don't know where that comes from, but apparently that was picked up in a wiretap or some sort of communication that Mega, you know, had to be protected, or that Mega was the source of these. I never found that term in any of the files that we've gotten from the court or from NCIS on that. So we may never know.
Yeah, maybe, it may or may not be connected there.
Maybe it's something Bamford can tell us about.
Yeah, I've asked him about that before, but it's been many years now. I don't remember.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks very much for coming back on the show. Always love talking
with you. Thanks for having me on. Congratulations on the 4,000 podcast.
Hey, thanks, man. Appreciate that.
All right, man. See ya.
Hey, y'all. That's the great Grant Smith. We'll be right back after this. Oh, earmep.org.
Superior blends of premium coffee. Roasted fresh in Zionsville, Indiana. Darren's Coffee satisfies the casual and the connoisseur. Scott Horton Show listeners, visit darrenscoffee.com and use the coupon code SCOTT at checkout for free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Because everyone deserves to drink great coffee.
Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our next guest on the show today is Alex Narasta, from the Cato Institute. This one's called Syrian Refugees Don't Pose a Serious Security Threat. And I guess, well, first of all, welcome to the show. Alex, how are you?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Good to have you again. Appreciate you coming on. So you've got some gall here trying to come at beliefs with a bunch of numbers and facts and stuff like that. You must think you're a real big shot. But anyway, so pretend that I'm a right-wing jerk and therefore I'm terrified of everything, and especially Syrians. And bonus, take into account that Obama and the NATO and GCC allies have in fact been backing the terrorists in Syria for the last 4.5 years and have probably created tens of thousands of them. And so quite possibly some of them would seek to dress up like a refugee and try to get into Europe or into the United States. But anyway, taking that into account, pretending I'm a right-wing jerk, go ahead and convince me. Make your case.
So taking a look at the refugees we've let in so far from all over the world from the year 2001 onward, none of them have been convicted of planning a terrorist attack in the United States. We've let in about 860,000 of them. There have been 3 convictions of folks for planning terrorist attacks abroad in other countries. So that's about 1 conviction for every 286,000 of these refugees who have been let into the United States since then. The threat is extremely low.
Well, wait, you're telling me the FBI hasn't even entrapped one of these guys this whole time?
Well, there have been more entrapments for people who came in prior to 9/11. Around 9/11, a lot of the security features in the refugee program were expanded significantly. It was made a lot more difficult, a lot more onerous. So some people from before then have been indicted on planning terrorist attacks, but almost all of them were abroad as well, not for domestic attacks. The best estimates we can see is that since 1975, around a dozen people have been, a dozen refugees have been convicted of planning or trying to participate in terrorist attacks over that time period, which is about 1 conviction for every 271,000 people admitted as refugees, or 0.00037%. So we're talking about infinitesimal numbers, very low risk, and you have to look at it from the terrorist perspective. If they want to come in and do harm in the United States, the refugee program is probably the hardest and most difficult way to do it.
Okay, and why is that?
Because there are, well, first off, you have to be a refugee. You have to go into one of these camps and register with the United Nations and be a resident in one of these camps. And that can take anywhere between 1 and 6 months to register. Then you've got to be in these camps and begin the American process, get referred by UNHCR to the UN, to the U.S. government for refugee resettlement, which starts, in the case of refugees, a 3-year-long process with 21 different administrative steps, numerous different security checks through the FBI, through DHS, through USCIS, through Director of National Intelligence. And they are finding a way to try to deny you access. So they interview you, your family, anybody you say you knew, anybody from the town that you say that you were from, to see if there's some kind of fishy background information or if you're lying. And if you are, then they reject you. So they assume that you are guilty until you prove that you are innocent. So through this entire process, if you are a refugee, a Syrian refugee in a camp, your chances of being resettled in the United States is about 0.04%, and it takes over 3 years. So if you're a Syrian refugee or a Syrian terrorist posing as a refugee, there are lots of better ways to try to attack the United States than going through this really complicated process that weeds out the vast majority of people who want to come in the first place.
Yeah. Well, it's actually almost amazing when you got how many zeros were to the right of the decimal point there when you counted the percent, 0.00, how many, 1%?
So for all refugees convicted of a terrorism offense since 1975, it's 0.00037%.
Wow.
And if you're a Syrian refugee in a camp, your chances of being approved to come to the United States is 0.04%.
And the chances that guy is going to be an ISIS sleeper cell terrorist is less than nothing.
I mean, it's small. I don't want to say zero because anything can happen, but it is so small that it's not a risk worth worrying about. I mean, there are lots of other risks worth worrying about. I mean, one of the things that I'm hesitant to say because people might use it to decrease individual liberty a little bit is a lot of these folks are just like these attackers in Paris could have, a lot of them were European citizens. They could have just hopped on a plane and come to the United States through something called the Visa Waiver Program. Would have been a piece of cake. Mm-hmm. But they didn't do that. So, I mean, there's lots of virtually any other way of getting to the United States is easier and less onerous than the refugee system.
Right. Well, and that's the real trick, man, right there, is that there have been thousands of Europeans who have traveled to Syria to fight, and at least scores, I don't know if it's more than 100 or more than 200 or something, of Americans who have gone. And, you know, I don't have any faith in the national police forces and intelligence agencies of the West to keep all these guys from coming home. Or, I mean, yeah, in fact, they don't really have the right to keep them from coming home unless they want to charge them with treason for fighting for al-Nusra or something like that. They could arrest them once they get here.
Exactly. And that is actually the more severe threat. You see, it's not the exports from Syria that are dangerous, but it's the re-exports, right? It's the Europeans and Americans who have gone there as fighters and then who come back, you know, more radicalized or energized or pissed off or, you know, whatever their deal is. And those are the dangerous ones.
Yeah, better trained.
They're trained and they have experience and, you know, they sort of, they've tasted blood. So now they want to come back and have more. That's the serious threat. But that is a partially homegrown threat made more dangerous by exportation to Syria and then reimportation.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
It turns out that the French and Belgian governments are spending most of their time, you know, tracking these folks because they know those folks are the most dangerous ones.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, the thing is, too, is I think we've been really lucky when you look at the number of, for example, and again, you know, I'm a little hesitant to say this because, like you, I don't want to play into the police state in any way or anything like that, but I'm just trying to be realistic about it, where you've had at least dozens of Somali Americans from Minnesota, living in Minnesota, go travel to Somalia to fight for al-Shabaab, the local now al-Qaeda affiliate after America turned their society upside down, of course, fighting against the American-backed government there. And, of course, any idiot, any one of them could have decided to just stay here and fight the same war, but on this side of the line, as simple as that. And,
absolutely.
You know, yeah, so picking on the refugees who are fleeing for their lives from the terrorist groups that America has created and nurtured, whether we're fighting against them or for them, we do nothing but make them more and more powerful, you know, day by day and year by year here. To persecute their victims fleeing for their lives seems a little bit unfair to me, but what do I know?
It's unfair, and it's not even a good way to fight terrorism. It's not even a good way to make us safer because the threats are so insignificant. And the point about the Somalis who are settled in Minnesota is a good one. In fact, the first American who committed a suicide bombing attack was a Somali-American from Minnesota who graduated high school in 2003, who went back to Somalia and did all that, committed a suicide bomber attack against a Somali, you know, the quote, legitimate government there, unquote, yeah. Attack. So those people are the most dangerous.
All right. Well, I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, The Scott Horton Show, here on the Liberty Radio Network. I'm talking with Alex Narasta. Sorry, I think I got that a little bit wrong. Pretty close, though, right? Narasta?
Oh, yeah. That's good enough.
Okay, cool. He writes for Cato. This article is called Syrian Refugees Don't Pose a Serious Security Threat. He broke out his calculator and showed it. Check him out there at Cato.org, and we'll be right back with more after this. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at Darren'sCoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com.
you hate government, one of them libertarian types, or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Talking with Alex Narasta from Cato. And he wrote this piece, Syrian refugees don't pose serious security threat. And one thing I wanted to clarify here real quick, I'm obviously not trying to give advice to any young Somali Americans of where they ought to be attacking things. And I'm certainly not trying to agitate from below for government persecution of Somali Americans living in Minnesota or anywhere else. My point is that the American government's got to stop bombing Somalia. America's been killing Somalis nonstop since 2001, and that's why it's a threat. And they're the ones who got to knock it off. They're the ones who have got us into a situation where we even have to discuss this being a possible threat in the first place. It's the foreign intervention and the blowback, and everybody knows that, but sometimes it's got to be restated. And then the other thing, and this is a little bit, or I'm not sure if you mentioned this in your article, Alex, it's a little bit beyond the purview of the point you're making, I guess, but it's pretty obvious, too, and it's been well written in other places, at least, that the Islamic State guys are trying to get Americans and Westerners to react. They're trying to get American, the Western majorities to turn against the Muslims that live among them in order to sharpen the contradictions between us, make them feel unwelcome in our countries and want to go back so they can have their bogus war civilizations that they're trying to put over on their victims, just like the hawks on our side are trying to do. And so our hawks, and especially on the issue of refugees, you know, innocent men, women, and children fleeing for their lives, is playing directly into the hands of our enemies, the Al-Qaeda and Islamic State forces, who this is exactly what they've been saying all along, is that Bush is right. You're either with us or you're with them. Can't be this. There, in fact, ISIS calls it the gray zone, what we call civilization, where people tolerate and each other and get along.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think that that's definitely the motivations. And there's a couple new academic papers that have come out that have taken a look at the assimilation of Muslims in the United States in different places based on sort of the discrimination or the perceived threat from the government in terms of civil liberties. And what you see is that in places where they're sort of the least molested, you have greater female participation in the labor market, more education, more people working, more people out of the home, more people out of their communities, and basically better assimilating in places where it's a more open society, which is exactly what we would expect. And it's that type of assimilation, free flow of ideas and people moving around in a cosmopolitan, open civilization that does decrease the risk that of terrorism.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's the same thing as, it's a different argument or, different topic, but same thing basically as immigration of Hispanics from Latin America, Mexico, and Central and South America. Where, oh, no, they're going to change our culture. Well, maybe if we treat them like individuals, they'll appreciate the individualism in our society and they'll want to preserve that. The same thing we want to preserve. How about that? But instead, we treat them like they're all a collective and have no minds or ideas or planned behaviors of their own. What would they have about America that we're trying to preserve that they would want to identify with at that point?
What's remarkable, though, is even despite those attitudes and despite a large number of Hispanics being unlawful or illegal immigrants from Central and South America, they and their kids are assimilating at an incredible rate, a little bit better or similar to the way that Italian Americans assimilated about 100 years ago. So a similar trend, learning English, identifying as Americans, becoming educated, climbing up those income ladders. It's going fantastically well, much better than anybody ever anticipated, because the strength of those ideas, those notions, the opportunity, the economic opportunity from being here is so powerful that it even overwhelms a lot of these nasty people saying mean things about them. It makes them still want to be American. Yeah. And that's a remarkable thing to me.
Yeah, that's a great point. And, well, let me challenge you a little bit. I presume you have some numbers to back up what you're claiming there.
Yeah, so there's a remarkable new report by the New Academy of Science, National Academy of Sciences, where they took a look at all of the papers written about assimilation in the last 10 or 15 years, and they combined them and did their own work. And it takes a look at 17 different features of assimilation. So everything from self-identifying as an American by generation, religiosity, income, education, where you move and live in the United States, and all that. And it shows, like, fairly remarkable, especially when you do it right, remarkable rates of assimilation. Because one of the problems is assimilation can take generations. So one of the problems is you have, like, second or third or fourth generation descendants of Hispanic immigrants, but many of them don't even self-identify as Hispanic because they're so assimilated. So when you take account of those people and try to find who those people are and measure their success in the United States, it's remarkable pace of assimilation. Basically, by the third generation, that is the grandkids of the immigrants themselves, they are indistinguishable from other Americans.
Yeah, that's interesting. They think of Hispanic as a nationality rather than a race, which is really more accurate anyway, right? And so they just they identify American as a race too, in that sense, or confuse those notions in that sense.
Well, the funny thing is, Hispanic is actually invented. That word and identification was invented by the U.S. government in the 60s to have sort of a census category to try to track these people from Central and South America, sort of one big block of people. So we see in the first generation people, of course, who come here mostly identify as the country where they come from, like Mexico or Honduras or whatever. And then in the second generation, there's sort of more of a pan-Hispanic, pan-Latino sort of identity, with Americans starting to creep in as sort of a significant self-identifier. And then by the third generation, it's basically split between Hispanic and American. By the fourth, it's just American dominates, totally dominates in terms of that. And that's not really odd by the third generation. Lots of Americans who have been here forever identify as Irish or other identifiers in terms of, who they are as Americans. Like, it doesn't, just because you identify as, like, Irish or Catholic or Muslim or some other sort of identifier prior to saying you're an American doesn't mean you're less of an American. There's been a lot of research on that, saying if people who say that they're Hispanic American are less patriotic than other Americans, and they're just as likely to say on surveys, you know, America is the best country in the world and stuff like that.
Right. Yeah, of course. Yeah, and that's an important point to make. It's not like you're saying, so that's why we should let them come here. It's just, look, even all your worst fears are debunked. So it's really okay. You know, whether they really were or not, they still got a right to go where they want and do what they want, which is a separate question.
Absolutely. Like, there's this great quote by Adam Smith. After the British lost the Battle of Yorktown in 1781, the student came up to him and said, oh, that's it. The British Empire is ruined. England is ruined. And Smith's response was, there's a lot of ruin in a nation. And so the institution, it's really hard to ruin what's here because so much of it is still built up over centuries through our culture and everything else. You know, it takes more than a couple of defeats or more than a few generations of bad government policy to destroy that. And our ability to assimilate these people, to make our civilization welcoming, just on the social and individual level, is so great that it overwhelms all these bad policies.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, and hey, listen up, too, everybody. I want to recommend to you this article at McClatchy, D.C., where they quote Alex in here, too. The article is Refugees Settle Quickly and Grow the Economy. They don't all come here and get on welfare. They come here and open up ethnic restaurants so that we have tasty food to eat instead of just the same old hamburgers. So, yeah, imagine that freedom working out. It's just amazing, but it tends to. Listen, man, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your time again on the show, Alex.
It's really my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, y'all, that is Alex Narasta. He is at the Cato Institute. The one at Cato is called Syrian Refugees Don't Pose a Serious Security Threat. And he shows his work there with mathematical numerical proofs. And then also this great piece again at McClatchy is refugees settle quickly and grow the economy, experts say. Back in one sec with Trevor Tim.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Next up is Trevor Tim from the Freedom of the Press Foundation. And they are at pressfreedomfoundation.org. Wait, didn't they fix that? Anyway, and he also writes for The Guardian, writes great stuff for The Guardian. Welcome back to the show, Trevor. How you doing, man?
Hey, great. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you back on the show. You know what? Before we do the exploiting the terrorist attack stuff, let's talk a little bit about the Republicans and Russia column that you wrote a couple of weeks or so ago, or a week ago.
Sure.
We ran it on antiwar.com, and I remember thinking when I read it, wow, I really should have gone through one by one and done the work that Trevor did here, collecting these quotes of these nutcases. These are the presidential candidates. Audience, get ready. I mean, go ahead, tell them, Trevor, what these kooks have to say about America's relationship with Russia. And everyone, no need to mention, but I'll mention anyway, keep in mind, they still have thousands of hydrogen bombs. Thousands of them. Okay, I'm sorry. So go ahead, Tim, Trevor, you got two first names, it's not my fault. go in whichever order you think is funniest, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, they're all pretty funny slash terrifying. For the past month or so, all of these candidates have been trying to outdo each other for who would do what with Syria, and they've kind of run out of ideas. And what the idea that they've all settled on is that there should be a no-fly zone. The only problem is that Russian planes are regularly flying over Syria, also doing combat missions. So then the question became, well, so are you saying that you're going to shoot down Russian planes and potentially start World War III? And all of a sudden, all of these Republican candidates started coming out and saying, actually, yes, that's exactly what we would do. Ben Carson said, you shoot them down, absolutely. Whatever happens next, we deal with it. That's an actual quote. And whatever happens next, a.k.a. nuclear war. Carly Fiorina said, I think we must be prepared to shoot down Russian planes. Chris Christie said, call Putin and tell him, listen, we're going to enforce a no-fly zone, and then as soon as he flies in your territory, you take him down. It's just on and on like this. Pretty much every Republican candidate, save Rand Paul, is now for starting war with Russia over Syria, which at the same time, they could care less about the actual people of Syria. They're just interested in dropping more bombs. So, it's quite alarming. Beyond just the whole starting World War III with Russia part, the no-fly zone, as the former Joint Chiefs of Staff actually pointed out in Congress, but which nobody actually talks about ever, is that it requires 70,000 U.S. servicemen. And that if you're even going to do these safe zones they're talking about, that means thousands and thousands of ground troops. So, and I shouldn't be just talking about Republicans here. Hillary Clinton has called for a no-fly zone and essentially is calling for tens of thousands of troops to be deployed at or near Syria. And, it's really mind-boggling when you think about exactly what they're calling for here, yet they just kind of do it on the fly, kind of shoot from the hip style.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's so much ridiculousness here. I don't even really know where to start, but I guess maybe we start with the fact that the military doesn't want to do this. And that's why they're lugging around this giant poison pill. The Air Force is telling Congress, yeah, no, we'd have to bring the whole army with us. And the army would say, we don't want to go. I mean, come on. They don't want to do this at all. And it's thank goodness for the calm, patient restraint of our standing army, keeping our civilians at bay. Again, one of the ironies of living in an empire where, you know, they'll fight any war at any time, but really wants to fight directly for the Al-Qaeda guys? Can't we fight against them for a little while again or something like that instead, you know?
It's really funny that it's actually the military that is being like, no, actually, this is a really dumb idea. We shouldn't do this. And yet, you know, it's all the politicians, you know, pushing it day in and day out in the media.
It's completely amazing. And then the other thing is, supposedly, America and Russia have the same enemy. And no one doubts that Russia is bombing the Islamic State and al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda in Syria. And so why in the world? I mean, okay, if you're the average Joe living room, aren't you scratching your head wondering what the hell is going on here that we want to get into a war with Russia over bombing the same side of the civil war that we're bombing?
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that, you know, the U.S. hates all sides. And so what it wants to do is essentially insert itself into the middle of a civil war, yet fight both sides. And so it's just would be a never-ending quagmire that it's hard to describe how ridiculous it would be and how there is absolutely no plan to get us out. And the idea is that these guys are willing to also throw into the mix the chance for a larger world war is beyond absurd.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I don't know if you saw the thing of Hillary Clinton's speech at the Council on Foreign Relations, but I actually haven't had a chance to watch the whole thing yet. But at the end, Fareed Zakariyyeh has like a question and answer thing with her. And he says, so this policy where we're going to back the moderate rebels and they're going to defeat Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State and Assad's army and Hezbollah and Iran backed by Russia and then create a secular democratic government in Damascus. Is that still what we're doing here? What do you think? Is that what we're gonna... And she laughs and goes, oh, well, when you put it like that. But of course, that's the policy. Gee, damn it, that they've been pursuing here for, you know, 4.5 years straight. That's exactly what they said they're doing. And for him, like, oh, come on, that's not fair for Reed to say it all in one sentence like that, where it sounds ridiculous. And then, so, but then she at least pretended to back down a bit and say, no, well, we have to prioritize and at least focus on the Islamic State. And, you know, maybe get back to Assad later, that kind of thing. But, I don't know. I just thought it was funny that, you know, when you quote the Republicans saying, whatever happens next, we deal with it, that could be her presidential campaign slogan as well, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. That's why it's just amazing that both parties are kind of throwing out these nonsense, quote-unquote, solutions, and that, you know, barely anybody gives them a second thought, and the media doesn't analyze them at all. And so people are like, oh, yeah, no-fly zone, that sounds great. Until you take 30 seconds to figure out what that actually means,
yeah.
Which is potentially a total disaster.
Well, what's funny is the reporters on TV are too stupid to even be confused. You know, like there's no cognitive dissonance when they're reporting the story of, you know, as you're describing it, America fighting on both sides of a civil war. They don't even think it sounds weird or anything. They just keep going on.
I think these. I don't know if it's the reporters or just the politicians or the people, but there is this notion that no-fly zones are enforced by magic, and that as soon as you declare one by saying it out loud, then magically all the planes in the country will stop flying, and you won't have to worry about a thing. I mean, the thing with the no-fly zone and why it takes 70,000 servicemen, like the Joint Chiefs of Staff told Congress, is because you have to take out the entire country's air force. With missiles, and you know, Syria with a significant air force, it's going to take a while, and who knows if it'll actually work. But you know, you basically have to go to war with that country and hope that they don't fight back. And so it's an incredibly dangerous proposition, especially in this area where there are more than just Syria flying combat missions, namely Russia. So
yeah, and the Turks. Yeah, specifically the Turks. I know, you said NATO. Right back after this with Trevor Tim from The Guardian. Republican presidential candidates would jump straight into war with Russia. When we get back, we're going to talk about how they're going to be spying on you worse and more than ever in the name of the Paris attack.
Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment, MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to MPVEngineering.com.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Wrapping up for the week here. Hey, it's Thanksgiving, man. Wrapping up early for the week with Trevor Tim on the show, writing for The Guardian. And we were talking about the Republicans want to get us in a nuclear war over stuff that they don't even know the first thing about, for Christ's sake. But now Paris is being used to justify agendas that had nothing to do with the attack is one. And then I thought I had another one here, too, by you, Trevor, along the same lines. Anyway, so let's talk about that. First of all, how many of the Paris attackers, Trevor, were refugees?
Zero.
Well,
it's incredible. I mean, so this is the thing that, you know, we've had this entire debate for almost 2 weeks now, a hysterical debate that's been driven by fear over whether we should ban Syrian refugees. The other debate that we've been having is over whether we should ban encryption because, you know, a day after the attack, dozens of intelligence officials came out and blamed encryption for the intelligence agencies missing this and going dark, as they like to say. And that, encryption, which is kind of the bedrock of privacy for billions of people at this point who use the internet, encryption is what Senator Feinstein called actually the Achilles heel of the internet. And the thing is that with both of these debates, they are entirely based off of rumor and entirely not grounded in reality. So from what we know, at least all the evidence we have so far, there's no evidence that any of the Paris attackers used encryption. In fact, there was plenty of evidence to suggest that they used all sorts of services that were able to be spied on by the government, including unencrypted SMS text messages, which is about the easiest thing to wiretap possible. They were posting and meeting each other on Facebook. You know, they even bragged in ISIS's English language glossy magazine that they were in Europe and going to attack. So the idea that the intelligence agencies are going dark was, just made up out of thin air, at least in this particular case. And yet the whole debate has been, well, we need a law to ban encryption. And, you know, the same thing can be said for refugees. We have taken in 750,000 refugees since 9/11. There has not been one terrorist attack completed by any of them. And yet there is this hysteria surrounding accepting refugees who are fleeing from the exact people that we say are our enemies. And at the same time, you know, the terrorist attackers in Paris were not Syrian nor refugees, yet we somehow think that by banning them, we're solving this problem when it, is just completely pulled out of thin air and is just, again, part of this whole fear and hysteria MO that happens after all of these attacks. And unfortunately, it's been fueled rather than tamped down by the media.
Yeah. All right. But so, you know, let me play the government's advocate here for a second and say, but geez, we sure could imagine bad people planning bad acts behind a cloak of encryption. And what if the cops can't protect us after all? You're saying there's no evidence that, okay, in this case, that these particular murderers plan their attack behind a wall of encryption, but geez, it seems like any terrorist who wasn't an idiot would. And so what about my feeling of safety, Trevor?
Well, you know, it's a good question, because the government pretends like just by saying the word encryption, all of a sudden there's this force field that, you know, turns up around groups of terrorists where they are impenetrable and we know nothing of what's going on, when actually that's not the case at all. There are still plenty of ways to conduct surveillance on actual terrorists, including their cell phone location information, so we know where they are 24 hours a day, all of their metadata for all the conversations they're having, even if they're encrypted, so we'll know who they're talking to, when they're talking to them, and for how long. And they also, you know, encryption doesn't stop the government in all cases from seeing what they're talking about if they are actually high-value targets. The government has plenty of powers to hack into cell phones and computers and see what the suspects are talking about. And all the encryption in the world is not going to help you if the government can't, or if the government can hack into your phone. What the encryption does is prevent the types of mass surveillance that have been going on that we've heard about through the Snowden revelations over the past couple of years, where the government collects hundreds of millions of people's communications, you know, people that are completely innocent of a crime, and puts them all in a database and is able to search them without any sort of evidence of wrongdoing. And so encryption is really kind of the bedrock of our privacy in the digital age. And so, you know, it's probably to no one's surprise that, of course, now the government wants to outlaw it.
Yeah. And now, so, but here's the other side of the question. Can the internet exist without encryption, or with encryption that can be broken at will by national governments like ours?
Well, it certainly couldn't exist at all without encryption in general. That's the problem with the debate, is that people like Senator Feinstein have no idea what she's talking about when she says the encryption is the Achilles heel of the internet. The internet would not exist. We would not be able to buy anything online. We would not be able to shop. We would not be able to do any sort of banking. The e-commerce would cease to exist without encryption. And the argument goes that, well, the government needs to be able to see everything that people are doing. The problem is that even if you trust the government 100% here, you know, what we're doing is basically carving a vulnerability into everything we do. So what I mean by that is there are, as you know, everybody who's paid attention to the news knows, been constant data breaches going on, whether it's Target or JP Morgan Chase or the Ashley Madison hack, where hackers and criminals and foreign governments are breaking into servers and stealing large quantities of people's information. Whether it's financial information, personal information, or otherwise, people's privacy are being violated by these third-party groups that we have no idea who they are. And so what the government is saying is that, yeah, give us the key because you can trust us. Number one, you can. But number two, even if you can trust them, all of these hacker criminals and other governments around the world will be able to find and steal that same key and be able to unlock everybody's communications all at once and do God knows what with all the information once they get it. So the government is not only proposing to violate people's privacy, they're also proposing to weaken their security. And I think that's the real key here, is that They're saying, well, let's improve security by weakening everybody's security, and it just doesn't compute.
Yeah, I think I read, it might have been Hayden or one of them NSA guys saying, when it comes to the foreign governments fighting with each other and the security of their systems, even as the NSA, he said, if it was a soccer game, the score would be 280 to 270 or whatever kind of thing, where there's a lot of great offense and very weak defense. It's very hard to keep determined hackers out of networks. Or I knew another computer security guy who just said there's no such thing as computer security. There's only the best we can do all day, every day, until it's not good enough. And this is what they want to pull the rug out from under.
Yeah, exactly. This is why this makes absolutely no sense. You would think, so you're absolutely right. There's all this offense and no defense. And so the way that you prevent people from hacking into servers and stealing millions of people's information is not having access to that information to begin with. So, for example, if you have an iPhone, now iMessages, when you text people iPhone to iPhone, they're end-to-end encrypted. So that means that only the person who you're talking to and on your phone can unlock that message. Apple can't even unlock it, even if they wanted to. So because they don't have the key and because they don't store the message, that means there's actually nothing to steal. So if somebody wanted to get every iPhone user's text messages, they would have to break into every single person's phone one at a time. So hundreds of millions of phones. It would take several lifetimes to do. And so they've effectively prevented hackers from ever doing that by designing their systems to be so that there is no key for them to have. And so this is what we should be encouraging everybody to do. Unfortunately, this is exactly what the government wants to be illegal.
All right, y'all, that's the great Trevor Tim from The Guardian. And this one is called Paris is Being Used to Justify Agendas. It had nothing to do with the attack. Thanks very much, Trevor. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
See y'all. Hey. Happy Thanksgiving.